as Republicans inch their way to a possible House majority, Democrats ink another Senate victory in Arizona. Nevada and Georgia are still up in the air.
We've got all the updates from the tense race. I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Aisha Roscoe, and this is Up First from NPR News.
President Biden says he wants competition, not conflict, when he meets with China's Xi Jinping next week.
He wants to know what Xi's, quote, red lines are.
Understand what he believes to be in the critical national interest of China, what I know to be the critical interest of the United States, and to determine whether or not they conflict with one another.
And celebration is the city of Kherson falls back into Ukrainian hands.
So stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
We begin this weekend with a little more information about the balance of power in the U.S. Senate.
Democratic Senator Mark Kelly has won a tough race against Republican Blake Masters, according to a race call from the Associated Press. NPR politics reporter Jimena Bustillo joins us now from Phoenix. Hi, Jimena.
Hey there.
This race took the better part of a week to call. Like, how close did it end up being?
Yeah, so there are still outstanding votes, but right now Mark Kelly is up by a little more than 5 percentage points, more than 120,000 votes. He took a lead in the counting earlier this week, and Masters simply never made up the difference. Kelly was able to pull enough votes to keep his seat, which is a major win for Democrats. And his strategy was to lean away from Biden and into moderate and independent voters. He even held a Republican for Kelly event with former Senator John McCain's staffers and his son Jack McCain. The former NASA astronaut was first elected to the Senate in 2020 during a special election following the death of McCain, so this will be his first full six-year term. GOP candidate Blake Masters received the Trump endorsement, but Kelly's win is so far showing that he may have gained a greater margin than last time and won over more voters. In 2020, Kelly won by 2.4% and 78,000 votes. And as I said, as of Friday night, he was ahead by 5% and more than 120,000 votes. Of course, final tallies are still to come.
So, I mean, 5%, you know, that's a comfortable margin in, you know, electoral politics. That could go up or down, but the AP says that whatever, you know, ballots are remaining, they're not enough votes for Masters to overcome, you know, Mark Kelly's lead. So, like, what took so long to get this result?
Vote tabulation in Arizona really is just a long game. Each county has their own method, and in Maricopa County, which is the state's largest county with the largest share of voters, early ballots are what took the longest to tabulate because they do it on a first-in, first-out basis. And a record number of voters, 290,000, voted on Election Day by taking the ballot that was mailed to them and dropping it into the box on that day instead of mailing it in earlier. That's 290,000 ballots to verify and count after Election Day. The morning after Election Day, there were 500,000 ballots generally just left to count in Maricopa County alone, and it really could have swung the election either way. Did Republican voters all save their vote until Election Day, or did Democrats vote early enough? The first set of those 290 that I mentioned delivered Kelly the win, so it's a good sign for Democrats for now in some of those other close races in the state.
Kelly is obviously instrumental if Democrats want to hold the Senate. What about other Senate races and control of the House?
Mm-hmm. With Kelly's win, there are 47 Democratic senators in the upcoming Congress, as well as two independents who caucus with the Democrats. We are still awaiting results from Nevada and Georgia. Nevada's Senate race will be decided in the coming days, while Georgia's heads to a runoff on December 6th. It's a little bit of a choose-your-own-adventure situation for the Democrats. If Senator Catherine Cortez Masto wins in Nevada, Democrats have a majority, and Georgia is just a bonus. If Cortez Masto loses, Democrats must win Georgia's runoff to maintain control of the Senate. As for the House, there's still no clear winner, though things continue to look good for Republicans to take the majority. Now, how slim of a majority that might be, we're just not sure yet. Here in Arizona, there are still two outstanding House races which are very close and haven't been called. And that's true of races all over, especially in California. So it's more of a hurry up and wait before we know exactly who might hold the gavel in the House at the start of the 118th Congress in January.
That's NPR politics reporter Jimena Bustillo in Phoenix. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson, joy in the streets. Ukrainians celebrated late into the night after Russian troops pulled out of the city.
Russia had occupied Kherson since the first days of the war. NPR's Greg Myrie is in Ukraine and joins us now from Kyiv. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Russian forces occupied Kherson for more than 8 months. First of all, what's the city look like now that the Russians are gone?
Well, this was the one city Russia captured without a fight, so it wasn't damaged like we've seen in other Ukrainian cities. But Kherson was cut off. It was really hard to know what was happening there. And in the final days, we're hearing accounts that maybe just 10, 20% of the population was left. Food, water, electricity were all scarce. And residents say the Russian troops were growing even more aggressive and detaining people for some very rough interrogations. So there was just this explosion of joy in the main square when the Russians pulled out. And a really defining image is residents giving watermelons to Ukrainian troops as they entered the city. The watermelon is the symbol of the Kherson region, which is a very rich farming area.
Russian troops retreated over a river, so how far away are they, and is there still a danger of fighting?
Well, there certainly could be. The Ukrainian military is urging caution. It says these 30,000 Russian troops that left Kherson and the west bank of the Dnipro River are just a few miles away on the east bank and setting up defensive positions there. Now, Russia also launched missile strikes at a number of places in southern Ukraine overnight, so the fighting isn't over, but the river is a natural barrier that will be difficult for either side to cross.
And a step back for a moment, Greg. How did Ukraine's military force Russian troops out of Kherson without any kind of battle?
Yeah, the Ukrainians began this very methodical offensive in the south in the direction of Kherson back in September. And there was lots of fighting in outlying villages, and the Ukrainians were making sort of relatively slow advances, capturing some of these villages. But they were still dozens of miles away from Kherson, and it wasn't clear if they were going to get there before the winter set in. Clearly, a big factor was the U.S. weapons the Ukrainians now have, these long-range artillery guns known as HIMARS, and they allowed Ukraine to hit the Russian troops from a long distance. Ukraine damaged bridges that Russia was using to resupply its troops in Kherson, and so the Russians knew they were in danger of being cut off, so they retreated rather than risk being trapped.
This, of course, is a huge defeat for Russia, the military, and Vladimir Putin's leadership. Can you tell how Russia's trying to spin this?
Yeah, Russia's defense ministry is digging very deep into its bag of euphemisms. It's called this a redeployment, a repositioning, a maneuver. Now, Vladimir Putin has gone absolutely silent. When his spokesman was asked about Kherson, he said this was a military decision and he had nothing to say. Now, of course, there's no way this could have happened without Putin's approval, and it's the latest in a string of humiliating setbacks. This is really Russia's third major retreat this year. First from the outskirts of Kyiv, the capital and the largest city, then from the areas around Kharkiv, the second largest city, and now Kherson, a major city in the south.
And NPR's Greg Myrie in Kyiv. Thanks so much, Greg.
My pleasure, Scott.
President Biden is in Asia this weekend, Cambodia today for a meeting of Southeast Asian nations, and Indonesia on Monday, where he'll meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit of the world's largest economies.
A U.S. president has not met the Chinese leader face-to-face in 3 years. NPR's John Ruich joins us to help us understand what's at stake. He's in Shanghai. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So the two leaders have spoken before, but they haven't met. Is that right?
Well, they haven't met with Biden as president. They met when he was vice president. They've had a handful of video conferences and phone calls since Biden became president. But bilateral relations really remain quite tense between China and the U.S. There's deep mistrust going in both directions, disputes over trade, technology, their worldview, which they really aren't talking that much about. And the expectations, while modest for this meeting, there is sort of hope that face-to-face interaction will be more useful than phone calls. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, talked to journalists on board Air Force One yesterday on the way to Asia, and this is what he said.
It's not about deliverables or trying to produce some joint statement. It's about the leaders coming to a better understanding and then tasking their teams to do intensive work to come back for further engagements between the leaders. I think,
you know, the Chinese leadership has been pretty unhappy with the Biden administration's general approach, which is focused on competition with China and countering Chinese threats or perceived threats. You know, how much Xi Jinping is going to be willing to sign on to further engagement is unknown.
You know, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan in August, and Xi Jinping had this to say about it, quote, "Those who play with fire will perish by it." Is that the kind of language that we should expect to hear at this meeting?
Might be. I mean, Taiwan is the corest of core issues for China, right? The ruling Communist Party just added a mention of it to its party charter at a party congress, which highlights its importance to Xi Jinping. Biden said this week that he wants to use the meeting to clarify, quote, red lines on both sides when it comes to Taiwan, but that he won't make fundamental concessions. You know, the administration's been pretty consistent in saying that U.S. does not support Taiwan independence, but Biden's also said on several occasions that the United States would help Taiwan militarily in a conflict with China, which is unusually explicit. So in Beijing, there's a very high degree of skepticism. Beijing thinks that Taiwan is part of China. Of course, it wants it back, and it sees the U.S. standing in the way. So yeah, Xi Jinping might have some strong words.
How about the war in Ukraine and China's relationship with Russia, which is close?
Yeah, no doubt. Ukraine will definitely come up. China is a friend of Russia's. It's been sympathetic to Moscow's rationale for invading Ukraine. But Beijing has called for restraint from all sides. You know, the U.S. in the past has tried to get China to use its leverage with Russia to end the war. There seems to be kind of a growing effort to get Russia and Ukraine to the negotiating table. And I talked with a Chinese scholar who declined to be identified, and he really thinks there may be a role for China in this that overlaps with U.S. interests to a certain extent. You know, separately, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said Biden hopes that China can play sort of a similar role in restraining North Korea, which has tested dozens of missiles in recent weeks.
You're there in Shanghai. What's the view from China on this meeting?
People aren't too optimistic. You know, in China, the tensions in the relationship are blamed solely on the United States. I had a conversation with a professor named Zhu Feng. He's with Nanjing University. He thinks Xi Jinping is going to urge Biden to try to bring the relationship back to a more balanced state. But with the Republican Party potentially taking control of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate, Biden's maneuverability on China, he thinks, is going to shrink.
There's a great deal of Taiwan sympathy among Republican hawks. That's what I'm really feel very, very afraid of.
Taiwan's sympathy, and he's afraid of it because friction over Taiwan could lead to a conflict.
That's NPR's John Ruwitch in Shanghai. Thank you so much, John.
You bet, Aisha.
And that's a first for Saturday, November 12th, 2022. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe. Up First is back tomorrow with the story of soccer star Lionel Messi's loyalty to his country and the cost of leaving home.
And we have more news, interviews, books, music, entertainment every weekend on this newfangled instrument called the radio.
Weekend Edition, every Saturday and Sunday morning on your local NPR station. Find your station at stations.npr.org.